Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi everyone, I'm Lee Salisbury and welcome to another episode of Soap from the Box, the podcast where I talk to stars of EastEnders, Coronation Street, Emmerdale, Hollyoaks, Home and Away and Neighbours. Every Sunday we are releasing two episodes this series, so I'm going to shut up because you've got two episodes to listen to. This one is an Emmerdale legend, you're going to love it, she's brilliant, enjoy. Before her role in Emmerdale, my next guest had already won a Best Actress Award at the Monte Carlo Film Festival and starred in huge hit Biker Grove, along with so many other things. She was nominated 7 times and won at the British Soap Awards and played, and I'm not joking here, my second favourite character ever in Emmerdale, closely beaten by Edna. Please welcome the incredible Charlie Harwick, who played Bao. Hi, Charlie.
Who are you talking about?
I was trying to do really clever intros, you know, like Lauren Laverne on the Desert Island Disc, but I'm not very good a writer, so I'm doing my best.
Well, that's very nice of you. I'll not get my head out the door.
And Monte Carlo, just to mention quickly, I mean, that must have been amazing.
Yeah, but I wasn't there, Lee, sadly.
Oh!
In absentia, because, we didn't know that the film I made, it was a film called The Scar, and I made it with Amber Films, yeah, I think in about 97, and it was really very, very successful in on the continent, shall we say.
Yes.
And then suddenly I got a phone call from somebody called, Charlie, you're nominated and it's looking really good. And it's like, what? And I tried to get a flight out and I couldn't get a flight out just to go to the ceremony. I thought would be exciting.
Oh, oh yeah.
And then I won it. It's called the Silver Nymph.
The Silver Nymph. Oh my God, perfect. Perfect for you. Oh, how gutting you didn't go. I mean, I've been to Monte Carlo once and I tripped over, me and Paul went, my husband, and I tripped over Bono's dog as I was looking at Sacha Baron Cohen getting out of a car, and that was just a normal evening.
Is that like give the dog a Bono?
Yes, yeah. So we're going to spend, the idea of the podcast is we speak a bit about the soap that people love you for, and also then go through, you know, your life a little bit as well. So I always start with a memorable moment, and there's so many actually working with you. So there's two I'll mention. One was we were doing a storyline with Liz, who plays Diane, obviously. I think it was the admittance of an affair. And I just remember we had a little rehearsal, which obviously, as we know, never happened. And you both came round to my flat in Rodley. And I just remember both of you sat on the sofa, do you remember?
Yeah, and we loved it because me and Liz are, you know, we're dyed-in-the-wool theatre actors and we thrive on rehearsals. And as you know, if you rehearse, then you find the richness in everything and the nuance in everything. And it means that when you get to the set to record it, you can put us anywhere and we know the scene inside out. So it's beneficial, isn't it, Lee, to have a chance?
Oh, it is. I mean, people probably at home, I mean, we talk about it quite a lot on this, but yeah, how quick it is on soap and how you get on, you know, and all those discussions with actors happen at the same time as you're discussing cameras with crews you get about 20 minutes to get it start to finish. So yeah, I was glad I did that because we had some really big scenes. I think like you said, it's so beneficial. And then my other one was, I remember just vividly a day working with you when we did a story with Tiny the Baker, which was around the HIV storyline, and this big guy, do you remember? And we filmed, yes, a bed scene that was, you know, hilarious and sad at the same time.
Yeah, because it was part of the HIV storyline, and she kind of she wasn't with Paul. No, she
was trying to have a one night stand, I think, but was all nervous about.
She was being honest about it. She didn't want to not tell people. She wouldn't put people in danger, which I'm surprised because I think Val probably would. But it was how and when do you tell somebody? You know, when you're getting intimate with them, at what point do you go, by the way, I'm HIV positive, but we'll just be really careful. And of course that she'd waited until they were actually, I think, in the bedroom.
And that was one of obviously your biggest storylines, which we'll talk about. So Val was introduced on the 1st of February 2004. I mean, which seems mad that it's so long ago. I know, as the sister of Diane Sugden, and she finally left Val in August 2015. Obviously, she became one of the most loved couples as well, with Eric Collard, Chris Chattel. and, I mean, was this huge... I mean, like I said, and I'm not, you know, making it up, Val was my second... is probably one of my favourite characters, my second favourite character, because I just loved... It's one of those characters, you must have obviously felt this playing her, that you could do so much with.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't pull any punches. And she was a fiend and a narcissist and a bit like Trump.
Yes, yes, very similar.
You know, there was no danger, and I policed it rigidly that she wasn't going to be lovely. I think sometimes you're tempted to, don't make her too horrible. You know, you kind of protect the character and you want to nice her up a little bit and show her heart. And I was very, very keen that we never did. And that even when she was seemingly lovely at any moment, when it took her to look after herself, that's exactly what she would do.
It is. And Nina Wadia actually said to me, which may be a bit similar as Zainab, she said, what I discovered was to be, you know, these kind of people that are quite like that are just truthful. So if someone said, does my bum look big in this? You know, Zainab would say, yes, it does. Yeah. Which then gets a laugh. But in a way, that character's just being truthful. And I suppose it's slightly a bit like Val. You know, she would tell it as it is.
Yes, unless she was protecting herself or up to some kind of skullduggery, and then she would tell it like it isn't.
Yes, yeah, totally the other way around. So what I do to guide us through is a little quiz. Now, there's no pressure here. It's basically for me to lead on to stuff. But we will start to see if you do remember the answer. So what I love about this is the character description. Always on the lookout for the next man to fund her lifestyle, which is how she came in. Who did Val cheat on Rodney with? Which shocked me because I wasn't working on it then. I didn't realise she had a bit of this person. Do you remember?
I think there was a couple of people. There was Billy the murderer, but maybe that wasn't cheating on Rodney. And she had a young...
Yes, this is the one, yeah. Danny Duggar, his name was. Cleveland Campbell. I never realised that Val had a bit of him.
That was really, really early on. And, you know, he was only a bairn. I was terrified about squashing him, you know. Because she was twice his age. But, very early, very soon after I joined, I had to do massive flirtation scenes in the wool pack. She wore a lot of mohair at the time.
She did, I remember that.
Lots of fluffy jumpers. So there's lots of fluff always flying about.
Flying around on the left.
Emotionally, yeah.
And what was it like joining a show? I mean, obviously, Emmerdale was huge anyway, but you went in, obviously, as Liz, who plays Diane's sister. There was, you know, Rodney there, played by, obviously, Patrick Moore, who's amazing. Did you feel the pressure? I mean, as any actor, actress, I'm sure you did, going into such a big show.
Totally, it was terrifying. And, you know, it's a bit like you remember your first scene and then you remember your last scene. When you first start, you remember every second that you're on the set and every second that you're waiting to go on the set because you're so nervous. And I just remember that the first scene that I did was with Patrick, who didn't know me very well at the time and was, you know, very charming and very charming. And I had this scene with him where I was behind the bar in a fluffy jumper doing a massive, heavy flirtation with him, conversation. And I just remember Andy, the first, who had the loudest,
Action! Andy, yes, action!
And everybody used to drop their teacups when they heard it. But I remember I'm kind of going, and ready, in 5, 4, 3. And when they stopped the three, I thought, if I run now, in the can, I could just run like over the hills and far away, like the cat in Tom and Jerry when it runs until it's a tiny little dot in the distance. And then, of course, I just heard action, and I started to speak me lines. But my heart was—I'm surprised you couldn't see it in the fluffy jumper, like a captive bird under there, because I was so scared. I'd done filming before, but never at that pace.
No, I was going to say to you, because you had obviously done lots of theatre as well, and it must have been, yeah. I mean, I think it was, you know, working as a director and seeing people come in, which was then became part of my audition process, really, seeing who you thought might not be able to hit the ground running. But yeah, because you were used to obviously so many rehearsals and so many, you know, and it, I think that's why it's, and because it's not you're going on to some small TV show, it's suddenly going to go to millions, and that all must come to you as you're doing the first. As you're doing your first scene.
Yeah, it was a bit like everything was outlined in black felt pen, and inside the wool pack it was hot and it was tiny and it was dark, and it was just a bit like an out-of-body experience.
When also being in the wool pack, I suppose, someone said this who I interviewed about EastEnders, because if you're in the wool pack as well, everyone's eyes are kind of on you, especially if you're new. They're, you know, and you know actors will be thinking, oh, are they going to be any good?
Yeah, because it is, because you're on a stage, because it's filled with actors, and the camera will turn around and film everybody else's little bits. But especially when you're behind the bar, and, you know, I've been on the table, I've been on the bar, yes. I've been standing on the chair. You know, Val was a big one for making speeches, some of them 3 pages long, with the first assistant director show. We've got 3 minutes to get this. Oh, how understanding. So you're constantly, it's like being in a goldfish bowl. You're being watched and observed, and mainly, I have to say, supported by your fellow actors who all know what it's like to be in that situation. So that, you know, they're willing you on and wishing you well.
And you're right, because I think, I mean, I always got told, which is nice to me, that I was an actor and a crew director, because some directors, I think, are just crew directors. And that can obviously be, you could see that with some, you know, it's hard because almost sometimes acting is, the actors are the last piece of the puzzle that people think of, which is crazy for me. Isn't it? But yeah, so you're up against everything. But right, second question, who left Val money in their will, so she, which enabled her to buy half the wool pack?
Oh, it was lovely. The woman who lived on her own.
Yeah, you know who it is, Noreen.
No, oh, Noreen was a really lovely, lovely character and a beautiful storyline about a woman who everybody thought was strange, who lived on the edge of the village. I mean, it's a thing. It was an inspired story. It's that idea that, you know, when you live in the country and when you're a kid, you imagine everybody, you know, have you seen that woman who lives in that end house? And you weave stories about people. And, you know, people can get ostracised because of it and because of rumour and things. And this character, Noreen, had been, and bizarrely, her and Val struck up a friendship because Val had to do community service painting a house.
Yes, that was one of your early ones. Well, my funny story about her, and this is awful really, because I joined and she was on her way out, but I didn't, you know, I'd studied, as you know, you join us, I'd studied everyone, but she hadn't come on my peripheral. So she was, and they kind of made her, unfortunately, quite big what she wore and stuff. She did stand out. And I thought, so in my first scene, I thought she was an extra and I asked for her to be moved.
Oh,
she was distracting, I know. And then I remember her wig, you found her wig in the fire, wasn't it, in the thing? But I know, bless her. I felt awful, obviously. But then that enabled you to bow to buy half the pub. And I was going to say, you know, that must, you kind of must feel like you're cemented in if you get a share of the pub.
Well, I do remember the props department coming up and saying, congratulations, by the way, and me going, what? And also, Lee, people get their scripts and they read them straight away. Not me. If I'm in the middle of a storyline, I don't want to know the future. My fear is that I'll start to play it. I'll start to play towards what's going to happen. And I'd rather have it I'd rather have it like a zodiac.
That's a really good point, actually. I've never actually really thought of that. And that is, yeah, I suppose, yeah, you fear...
Trying to stay in the moment and not... Because if you know what's going to happen, like you do in life, if you knew what was going to happen, it affects your present behaviour. So I let things come as a surprise. And people used to say all the time, oh, you've got a great scene coming up. It's like, have I? It's like, have you not read it? No, I'll read it when that block starts, just before that block starts.
Because, you know, I always say it's like actors doing stunts. You know, if you have to have a pint thrown over you, I think it's so hard because it's very hard not to expect it.
We just talked about a pint. I had a terrible thing once, and it was pressure. Matthew King timed a line by drinking a pint down, and I had to come up and interrupt him just as he got to the bottom of it. And I was so aware of where he was and that I had to be accurate. I blocked the lens. And he was like, he was going, Charlie, and I was, I'm so sorry, Matthew. It's just the pressure's too great. So he had to down three pints.
And they use real, I mean, that's always quite astounding me. They actually use real beer. They don't in any EastEnders. It's something like, you know, something disgusting like ginger ale. Yeah, it's always quite astounding that it's real beer.
They don't know, Lee. They stopped that possibly after that incident.
After that, yeah. Well, I remember you'd come in possibly sometimes, you know, you'd had a couple of drinks the night before and you'd smell the beer in the pub at 8 o'clock in the morning to start filming. You'd think, oh, I think Nick Miles used to quite enjoy having the dog in the morning.
Yeah. And what I used to like was the cocktail cherries behind the bar and a bit of lemon. Well, that was nice. But when I first came in, I smoked.
Yes, of course, Val smoked quite a lot. And you did you smoke?
Yeah. The smoking ban didn't come in to real life until, was it 2008 or something?
Yes, yeah.
For the first 4 years, I had an ashtray and me cigarettes. Well, when I came on set, the props team would bring me cigarettes, except I smoked herbal cigarettes, which smelt like fish, like kippers.
Oh, yeah, they smell disgusting.
Yeah, they do. So that was the worst part. People used to go, oh, has Charlie been in here smoking a cigarette? And it's like, sorry, I didn't
Isn't
want
that
to have...
crazy now to think of smoking on a set? I mean, it's mad. I mean, obviously I did EastEnders with June Brown and they had to get round the smoking ban by putting every scene that she was in, there had to be a disclaimer saying June Brown may smoke in this scene. and then they got away with it and she just chain smoked. I mean, literally the whole time. That amazing woman, amazing. She is still with us after how much she smokes, but... so June was the only one who got away with it. But, okay, so who did Val and Pollard Foster?
Ah, Amy.
Amy Wyatt, yes. Chelsea.
Gorgeous Halfpenny. Oh.
I mean, she is one of the most gorgeous. And she's been on this. And she said, I meant to play you a clip, but she said that obviously her most enjoyable times were working with you and Chris. And, I mean, that's when we were all there. And she said it kind of never felt the same afterwards. And she said that what she loved was, you'd always said, it kind of reinvented Val and Pollard slightly, having her.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, Val had her own children. She wasn't really that bothered about them. But then this girl came into their lives and Val suddenly was fierce to defend her.
She
was more her child than the other two were. But also... I really loved her. I remember our first day on set and she was just watching me and Chris with her mouth open because me and Chris had worked together for so long. We shorthanded everything and me and Chris get on like a house on fire. I'm so lucky that he was my pretendy husband. Best marriage ever. You live in separate houses and you never sleep together.
Yes.
It's a very harmonious relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, I used to love working with you two because it was, you knew if you worked with you two that things were going to be organic, which I love, because I don't like going on and just going, right, this is what I thought, and then no one has an opinion. You know, I love the fact that we would work always as a team on scenes with you and you could see magic happening, I think. Do you know what I mean?
And we recorded mostly in the village. So the B&B is done out like a B&B inside. So it wasn't a big leap of the imagination for us to pretend that we ran a B&B in the village because that's where we used to film. And it used to make things organically happen. And we knew the set really well. So we could say to you, you know, right, can we do this first bit where I'm out of sight and then I can just burst through that door?
Yes,
because
yeah.
We knew how to set up the cameras and you could really use the set like it was a living, breathing space. So that was a real treat for us. But yeah, Chelsea coming into the village, and she had that awful holy jumper on that she used to wear all the time.
And red hair that she said made her hair nearly fall out, which you, I mean, because you started wearing a wig as well, didn't you? Because of all the, you know, what it does to your hair every day.
Yeah, because it was straightened. My hair was straightened every day, and my hair's so fine. I said, look, you know, you've got me soul. You're not getting me hair as well.
Yes.
But they were great. So they got a wig that was made to my hair colour and my hairstyle. So it was a seamless transition. Although I have to say that Val's wig was much more luxurious.
It was very, yes, it was. I remember it was almost carried around like a crown on this little head.
But yeah,
bringing up the B&B, which we haven't before, and I mean, obviously, so again, listeners, yeah, that's one of the, there's that set and there's the shop used to be on location. Yes. It was Edna's was down, not in a, it was Edna's was in Mill Cottage, which was Jimmy and Nicholas. But the B&B, I mean, as you will lay testament to, I mean, you've got the village outside, which is cold, but literally if you film in a house in the village, it's just as cold as outside, isn't it? And then the actors have got to kind of take off their coats and pretend we're in midsummer. I mean, it used to fathom me why it was so cold, but it was freezing, wasn't it, in those houses?
It was, and I feel so bad because I used to be screaming, shut the door! Shut the door!
But thank God, because everyone used to just walk in and out and leave it bloody open.
Because all the crew got balaclavas on. And
you've got thermals, North Faces.
Yeah, and you know, Val's in a sexy little blouse. Like, will you shut the door? You can see me breath. That's me breath. You can see me breath. You know, so, and of course, I knew where all the radiators were. And as soon as I came on set, before I even went into makeup, I'd be in the B&B turning them all on.
I would actually, if I had scenes with you guys, I would go in there before lunch or whatever and make sure they were on as well. Because I'm sure some people used to turn them off on purpose. But apart from, so you had Chelsea, I mean, and I do all attributes to Chelsea and you too, because I think, I mean, and no disregard to anyone else, but when you have, there's only certain people I think that can come in and just blow you away with their acting. And Chelsea was one of those, I think, you know, and that's always going to be, it's exciting when you see someone who's also so good, isn't it? Who then bring something new, because I mean I love the saying that you should always surround yourself by people you think are better than you, and it's that feeling of like, I loved working with her and you guys, because just when you've got that level of acting, it goes to another level, I think.
Yeah. It's making us wallow in it. I haven't thought about the detail of working with Chris and Chelsea, you know, for years. It's
years, I know. And I do miss those times. And then also, we mustn't forget, you know, Matthew and Natalie, actually, because I think as a family, you know, Matthew Wolfenden brought so much as David to your little gang as well, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, lovely. And like Chris. You know, they're both outdoor creatures. They're both sporty. Because, of course, Matthew, he was in Team GB. You know, he was a gymnast. And then he was a dancer. And he can sing, and it's like you could fold Matthew in half. He's symmetrical with a low center of gravity. So he could go on as an attacking midfielder for Newcastle with no warm-up tomorrow. He's sporty and physical, and so is Chris. And they're both, you know, probably about 5'8", 5'9". They're alike. So they worked beautifully as father and
son. They did, yeah. And also the three of you, I mean, you know, brilliant comic actors as well as being serious. And I think, is there a point you realise you're really good at comedy? Because, you know, I think it's the one of the hardest skills of acting comedy, actually, to get right.
Get away, man. You know you've got it when you're born with it, Lee.
I mean, yeah, I do. I mean, as a director, I think I've got quite a good comedy thing. So that you do know, you've got a pitch on for something, don't you? But because all three of you really had quite a lot of physical comedy as well as verbal. And that's, you know, quite hard to get right and make it good.
I'm not so good at the physical comedy. I'm terrible at pratfalls and things. Whereas Chris Chittell's great. He just, you know, he also bites you on the ankle when you're concentrating and talking to somebody else. That's not so good. Agile he is. But I've done loads and loads of comedy in theatre. You know, I've been involved in theatre since I was 19 years old.
Yeah.
And I am happy in both comedy and drama. I have a passion for both. But you're right, comedy is, it's much more technical. You know, drama, you can do it all from your soul your guts. But with comedy, you've got to time it. You know, like the best drummer in the world. If you miss the hi-hat, man, you're knackered. So it really relies on rehearsal.
It does, comedy. Yeah. Because I think you're right then. Drama, you can dredge up stuff. You know, you can put yourself sometimes in the position. Comedy, I don't think you can really, because a lot of comedy, you know, you don't really go, oh, that reminds me when that happened. It doesn't come really from the soul. It's much more of a skill in a way.
Yeah, and it's very technical. You know that if you look a certain way on a certain beat, you'll get a laugh. And if you miss it by a nanosecond, it'll just fall flat on its face. So
yeah, and I think the thing with theatre, what I kind of loved about theatre is that you get, you know, early on in the run, it's almost like you've got reviews every night. You can feel the energy from the audience of what works. But obviously in television, you don't really know.
No, you don't. And you don't know which shot's going to be used. And
yes,
it's a very technical exercise, which I have to say, Lee, when you said that you were an actor's director, you knew when you were working with you that you could come up and go, Lee, should I time that last bit? Are you going to use those shots where it's like over the shoulder? Because if it is, then I'll direct it there if that's what you're going to use.
Yeah.
So, and you were great because you would collaborate. You know, it wasn't anybody trying to say, I think you should do it like this. It's just, if you let me know, then we can help each other.
Yeah, which is the team, which is what it's about, isn't it? It is about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the final question was, who prompted Val to reveal her HIV status to the pub after posting about it online? And I'll give you a clue. He's actually on telly now with a pair of skates on.
But hang on.
So someone posted online in Emmerdale, the character, that there was someone at the B&B with HIV.
Oh, my goodness. Who was it?
Oh, it was Jacob, Joe Warren Plant.
Oh, of course. I'll get that pesky kid.
He's obviously, I mean, I watched Dancing on Ice the other week just to see him, and oh my God, I can't believe it was only about, you know, up to my chest when I last worked with him. And now he's this, you know, full grown man. It's mad to see. But that brings me to the HIV story, really, which obviously was, I mean, I remember at the time, I think the fact was that actually, what people didn't know was that a big percentage of people with HIV were ladies in their, you know, past their 40s, was it?
It was the fastest growing group, because it was postmenopausal women, and a lot of women thought that the menopause would bring them freedom and that they didn't have to worry about birth control anymore. And a lot of women getting divorced and finding new partners, and somehow did not think that sexually transmitted infections might be a big issue, especially HIV. And I don't know how, but I think people still thought it was a young person's thing, a gay thing, which of course it isn't. You know, and women fell into this trap. Somehow through ignorance, and they were the highest growing group that were contracting HIV.
I mean, I think ignorance will also probably help by our press, you know, that highlight it as a gay, you know, kind of disease more than anything, you know. So it was, in a way, you know, you're led, so many people are led by the press and what they hear, unfortunately, and it wasn't.
The community had wrestled it, and, you know, they had found a way, and of course science had come on leaps and bounds. But can I just tell you how it came about? Because Kate Oates, the producer, asked me to come upstairs. Yeah, I've been called upstairs. Yeah,
oh God, you know, it's either brilliant news or the worst news.
Yeah, so Kate said to me, she said, look, she mentioned that she knew somebody who had HIV, who'd phoned her up to tell her that they'd been diagnosed as HIV positive. And she said she was bereft. And she said, I'll rush round, what can I do? And she thought that they would be dying. And the person just said, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, we've progressed so much. I've been diagnosed, but I can take this medication. And if I am very careful, you know, blah, 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 it can be normalized, completely normalized. It's fine. You know, we've got to make sure it's prevented from spreading. But people can live full, happy, ordinary, healthy lives and be HIV positive. So she said that she wanted to let the public know about this. And I, in one of the plays that I was in when I was in a theatre and education company in the very early 1980s, when HIV was gripping people with fear and horror, and the Tory government at the time under Thatcher was trying to push homosexuality underground almost making it illegal to be out if you were in any form of public life, like as a civil servant, a teacher, anything. You know, this was clause 28, clause 29. So it was a terrible anti-gay, homophobic time, but it was so vital that we taught young people about this illness. So I was in a play then that toured around high schools teaching young people about HIV and saying, this is not gay only, this is not black only, this is not young only, old only.
You know, in a way it came around in a circle then, and then
we taught people how to have safe sex in school. I mean, obviously not practical sessions, but it was really candid and the play was really candid, but it gave young people a space where they could candidly discuss it without fear of being judged or, you know, condemned for asking questions. So when Kate said to me, would I be prepared to do it? I bit her hand off.
Yeah, I mean, as I've always said, soap, for me, one of the best things about soap is you can make a difference in these big, powerful storylines because it's in people's homes every day. And you can have a really slow building story. I mean, I will always mention the cop death I did with Charlotte Bellamy, which was astounding only for me because of the letters we got in, you know, and, you know, you felt like you were doing something so special, not because to win awards or performances, but because you felt like in TV that can be so, you feel like sometimes it's meaningless, your job, you know, then you've got, like you did with that story, you've got a real chance to highlight something, to make a difference.
To make a difference, absolutely. And, you know, I remember the first person when the storyline was just coming out. And, of course, you know, when you said before, who put it online? All I was thinking of was that the bloke that came to visit her to tell her that he had tested HIV.
Yes, yeah.
And I think I went into an absolute paroxysm of that because I loved those episodes. And he was...
It was a great character battle to choose. That's what I love. I remember when they wanted to bring a new gay person in, actually, and I suggested that they made Aaron gay. So I will take some of the credit for that. And I remember Danny at first didn't really want to do it, and because I said to them, why do we have to bring another? Can't it be? I said, there's a real thing about, you know, someone in a family like that, in a real Yorkshire family, that would really struggle because, you know, it's not in the family's makeup, and there's still so many families like that. And I think, you know, it's so important to get the character right to do that with, isn't it? And Val was perfect, I think, just because, yeah, because you wouldn't, it sounds ridiculous to say, you wouldn't expect it, you wouldn't, you know, and so it's great to, you know, it helps to shock people when it's a character you wouldn't probably expect.
Yeah, well, it shocked me when I got the script. And, of course, there'd been a storyline beforehand because she'd nicked off to Portugal and then came back with a friend who tagged along with her, who... I think you remember that storyline.
Yes.
Yes. yes. Lice, I think, were brought back by the friend, weren't they?
Yes.
So, but anyway, this was Val's holiday to Portugal. And she came back and, you know, swore on her own life that she hadn't been with anybody else, no matter what Pollard thought, no matter what tattoo she'd had, you know.
Yes.
And then I kind of believed it. And then, of course, this fella turns up and said, you know, we had that thing in Portugal. And it's like, shut up, man.
Yes.
Shut your face.
And I'm sure after that as well, though, Pollard, that Pollard and Diane had to admit that they'd had a bit of a thing. They'd been up to no good at the same time. What I loved is she expected forgiveness from Pollard, but obviously would never forgive him.
No, never.
So we'll bring it to the end, which was when, obviously, you were part of the huge helicopter crash. And you'd obviously left before for a few months to a play, but then you decided to leave. But you weren't expected to die, were you, at the time? You didn't know you were going to be dead in it.
No, and once again, this sounds absolutely ridiculous. If any actor had said to me before I was going to leave, the tall as me character was going to die, and I was absolutely devastated, I'd say, get a grip, man. And then the tall as me character was going to die, and I was absolutely devastated.
Yeah.
But I was really, really horrified. Not because I wanted to come back, not because I thought, I'll keep the door open, because I didn't want...
Bound to go. Out. Yeah, I know.
I just assumed that she'd go off after Amy, who was the biggest love of her life, you know. And the idea that Pollard was going to be...
On his own, I know!
It was terrible. And I even cancelled me leaving party.
I remember you did. I mean, I totally get that as well. I mean, I do think, like you said, it happened to Pam St. Clement as well when I was at EastEnders. I remember she came in the pub in the Vic, and obviously she had been told she wanted to leave as well, but didn't expect them to kill Pat. And I remember we were all in tears because it was like, you can't kill Pat. Like, you can't. I mean, I do think it's, you know, and I will say silly decisions when they get rid of characters who are so iconic and can come back. But, yeah, it's like you said, it was a bereft of losing that character. I mean, I remember the scenes with Chris afterwards, literally, were heartbreaking.
Oh, poor Ben. But do you know what pulled us around? I did pull myself around, Lee, which you have to do.
Yeah, isn't it?
It was terrible. It was terrible when I first heard. But I talked to my niece, Abby, and I went, you know, they want to kill her off. Abby, just between me and you, obviously, darling. And she went, well, the thing is, if you've got to go, you may as well go out with a bang. And I thought, you're right, you know, Abby, you're absolutely right. I've got to get over myself and I have got to make the most of this exit. And bye, we relished it.
Yes, and it was brilliant. And I do think, I mean, obviously, the different actors and different friends I know, I mean, obviously, as we know, if you go in the back of a cab, it means, God, you've been terrible.
it's just how you're thought of by the press.
Yes, totally, yeah. I mean, I think part of it as an actor, I mean, how did you feel? Because I think it gives you that, obviously, it gives you definite closure. Like Sam Giles says this on her podcast, you know, it's quite, in a way, she said she wishes she had been killed because you've always got it in the back of your mind. God, when, you know, times are hard and you've got a few months, should I go back? So, I mean, I suppose in a way it gives you that closure that you think, right. I mean, I'm saying this, I'm just about to lead on to the fact that you went back.
Yeah, this is a false ending. This is a good
comedy. It's a false ending. Because you did go back, obviously, to play what I love. I read this thing from Inside Soap magazine, which I do love. This is great. So when you went back as obviously as a ghost, they said no one else has ever done a better job of milking their death more than Val Pollard. Her DVD of Final Requests was Val-tacular and quite literally the campest thing ever.
Yes, that was the big I did it my way, which of course Trump had.
Playing with yes. Yeah, very-
And I did think, by God, he's nicked that off Val.
But I wonder if he did, and the big red hair, you know, kind of the ginger appearance from neck upwards as well. I watched this morning, the second time you went back, which was great, brilliantly filmed. I've never seen it when you were in white and everyone's
Christmas present.
Yes, it was great.
Yeah, it was fab. Yeah, where she smoked a pretendy cigarette.
Yes, and like Lucy had this most horrendous makeup, and then Robert, but what was it like going back? You know, was it strange? Because I know how things quickly move on and, the cast are unrecognisable, you know, when you go back a year, 2 years later.
Well, it was lovely because, of course, like we know, a lockdown, like we were talking before, Lee, what you miss when you're not working are the people. And going back and seeing the women that I loved in the makeup department and the man, only one man, the costume department and actors and just before I forget, what was lovely about the death scenes as well is that when I first came into Emmerdale, me and Liz Estenson had loads of two-handers, a bit like the ones that we talked about when we came around to yours. And at the end, me and Liz had the two-hander in the House of Mirrors. So we worked together, just solely us, for days. And that was a really lovely end.
Those end scenes are fantastic. And what I also love is the kind of throwback, like you said, to the beginning when she struck, you know, got a cigarette out.
Yeah.
That kind of was like a nice, you know, round circle as well, wasn't it? Kind of, and that power that she had by the end, you know, going, well, I'm just, yeah, it was a really, if you're going to, you know, like we said, if you're going to have to die, it was a good, because you and Liz, well, I mean, we have to mention you and Liz's relationship, so much to mention, really, but because that was, Had you worked with Liz? Had you met Liz? Because as we know, as actors, you're thrown into these relationships, and on soap, it's a big relationship, you know, sisters. Had you had time together before you started filming?
Only in the audition. And of course, I knew Liz, and I'd met her socially, but I'd never worked with her. But I loved working with her. She's, you know, she's a proper actor.
She is.
You know, she makes every scene work, and she takes every line seriously, and I loved creating these
that relationship. Yeah, what I loved, I suppose, is they were supposed to be a bit, you know, they were constantly at loggerheads and not. And I do think you and Liz are quite different as to work with as actresses, and that really works. You know, there's something amazing in that chemistry you had with her.
I completely believed it. Whenever I had scenes with her, I completely believed that she was my sister.
I kind of do still believe that. As much as I also still believe she's Teabag. So, I mean, I'll never get over that. So, yeah, well, okay. Well, that was Emmerdale, which was obviously amazing. And we'll move on, just so we've got time to talk about other stuff. So the real Charlie Hardwick was born in Wallsend, Tyne and Wear, as Claire Hardwick.
Claire, yeah.
So that's your real name. Is Charlie a stage name?
Yeah, Charlie's a stage. It was a nickname when I was a teenager, and it somehow followed me into a youth theatre after nobody had called us Charlie for years. And then when I was 19, I went to this youth theatre, and somebody was there that knew us as Charlie, just as this stupid nickname of the two Ronnies, Charlie Farley and Piggy Malone, were two detectives. I could have been Piggy Hardwick very easily, but my friend Linda had that name. And I had Charlie. So, you know, I came into this youth theatre, said, "Hiya, Charlie, how are you?" And say, it's Claire. And then people called us Charlie. And then once I'd done my first play, then it becomes part of your CV. So I keep it as an equity name, but people call me either. Family call us Claire. You can kind of, the people who met us after I was an actor, they all call us Charlie.
Charlie, yeah. Oh, so I thought it might be that younger listeners won't understand this, because equity, obviously, that you had to have it, you know, years ago. Obviously, if someone had the same name, which amazed me that so many more people did it, you had to change your name.
That's right. David Tennant, apparently, I heard last night, I can't remember his name was, but he changed it to Tennant because he just read an article by the Pet Shop Boys.
Oh, really? Oh, brilliant.
He told me your tenant's name.
And I think Nicola Wheeler went through about four names before she could choose one that she was allowed. Yeah. Was it a drama infused place? Was it there on your doorstep?
Not at all. I didn't
even know. Yeah.
Be an actor. You know, working class northeastern lass. I don't know. Maybe I thought that actors were grown in greenhouses somewhere, but it was nothing to do with my life. I loved drama on the television. I'd been to see an amateur production when I was at school and doing English literature O level. I saw View from the Bridge and thought, oh, it's great. But I had nothing to do with it. And then when I was 19, and my best friend Polly got engaged and didn't go out with me on a Friday night, went out with her fiance on a Friday night, I thought, well, I'm not stopping in. And I saw a little advert in the local paper saying that there was a youth theatre starting and you didn't have to do any acting and we might do a bit of singing and you can just tell about behind the scenes. And I thought, I'll pluck up the courage and I'll go along because it's something to do with a Friday when I'm not seeing Polly. And my life complete, completely changed that night. It completely, entirely changed course. I can't tell you. I don't know what would have happened to us.
I've
not stumbled across it. I was working in an office. I was a civil servant in the Department for Health and Social Security in Newcastle, where 12,000 other people worked. And I didn't know what I was going to do with. I didn't know. I just thought that was going to be it.
That was life,
That was going to be my life, even though what I'd wanted to do was ride around America on a Harley Davidson. That didn't seem to be what was going to happen. And then I just met all these other young people, had such fun, and these arts workers who said, "You're good at this, you know, you could go to college." And it's like, go to college? I don't know anybody who's been to college. Why would I go to college? It's like, so you could be an actor? Be an actor? I couldn't be an actor. And, you know, they kind of encouraged us. And luckily, I've managed to earn me crust as an actor.
Oh, yes, so you have. And I was the same a bit. I remember growing up in a small town in Sussex. And I remember going into you go for that careers advice saying, at the time I wanted to be an actor or a director. And they kind of laughed. Yeah. And someone would give you work experience in the local newspaper. And I thought that was the height of, you know, reporting on dog poo in a park. And I thought, well, this is all right. I just thought TV was something. I mean, I always think London was in my head, you know, like, unless you're from London, you know, you can't do it. And I was the same. I just saw one thing in the theatre, actually, and I just, with Maggie Smith, thought, no, this is what I need to do. Yeah. I need to do something in this industry. And once it gets you, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, if you've got that kind of energy, you know what actors are like? It's like herding cats. We talk, and most of us are on the front foot, and we're storytellers, and we love other people's stories. And to have that, this job as an outlet, oh, what a relief. Otherwise, we'd be imposing ourselves on people in all sorts of civilian world. Like,
yeah. Well, I think we're the kind of people, I think, especially actors, who can't just, you know, it's a big risk, as I always say when I do actor workshops, you know, it's a big risk to be an actor, because you will, I always think there's no other, because Paul, my husband, always says, God, all actors are a bit mad. and I always say, but to explain to people listening, actually, I've always said, because actors, you know, as a director, hopefully I'll never go back to being a runner, but actors, you're constantly not told in auditions why you didn't get the part. You don't get those calls. The self-belief in yourself is really hard to keep up, I think, as an actor, and your self-confidence. Yeah, because you have to be your own person. You have to be such a strong person to go through that. And you could be in Emmerdale, and then, you know, I know I've interviewed people on this, and no, it's not looking down on it, which our press do, which is then, you know, one's gone in as a fireman, one's a builder, and that's seen as dreadful by them. What a failure in the papers, which I think is disgusting. But it's that level of, that's what I mean, it's a very hard way to navigate, because to get that success is then very hard to say goodbye to as well as an actor. So you do need to be a strong person, don't you, as well as talented.
Yeah, you've got to. But luckily, I was talking to somebody yesterday. I don't think I'm better than anybody. I am so fortunate that I've stumbled into a world where I think I can do it. I can do it. It's like, I think I'm in the right job, you know, for the skill set that I've got. But there's been times where I haven't, and I had to run a French antique shop in London for 4 years, say. And I was no less an actor then, or no more an actor then, and no less a person, and no more a person.
Yes.
Which is, all people were all equal, and sometimes you get the opportunity, you know, the rare gem of an opportunity to be able to do that for your living. And I am so lucky that that's what's happened. But I don't think any less of anybody. In fact, anybody who went into the fire service or the ambulance service.
I know. I mean, yeah, God. I mean, incredible.
But humility.
Whoa. But yeah, I think you're so right saying that, and that's people's belief. And I do think, I always say to younger actors, you know, don't, I think the biggest thing these days, I want to hammer home on every show is, you know, don't do this for the fame, which is now publicised as almost what people are doing, you know, to be social influencers. You know, the fame is the worst part of the job. You want to be an actor. You want to be an actor. You don't want to be you don't want to be famous.
No. Well, there's nothing there. That's just empty.
Yes.
You want to be if you want to collaborate with other people, get to the knot end of every little nuance of a character and a character's relationship with other people. You know, if you love storytelling, if you can manage not to have a nervous breakdown and pretend that an audience isn't in front of you, then, you know, you go for it.
Yeah, totally. So there we go, everyone. Now, I mean, there's just so much in your career, Charlie, that we could mention. So I'm just, obviously, lots of theatre. TV-wise, you've done Our Friends in the North, Casualty, The Royal Bill, but the film Billy Elliot as well.
Oh, don't. I did loads on Billy Elliot, and I'm on the cutting room floor, except for one tiny little part where I pop my head over and say to Julie Walters, they're not in. But I spent a long time. I was involved in the workshop as well that led to the musical. Wow. And the whole development of it, because it's written by Lee Hall, who I've worked with loads, because he was a product of the youth theatre in War's End as well. He's the writer, obviously. We developed the play. It was started off being called Dancer, and it was a radio play, and then developed into a play, and then the film and everything. I'd have loved to have played the dance teacher in the musical, but I went into Emmerdale.
Yes, that's amazing to be involved. And, you know, what I always think there's something so magical about Northern films. Brastoff, Sue Johnson on the podcast talked about that. Isn't there? There's something so that you can't put your finger on it. Just just set them aside from other films.
Yeah, I did a really lovely movie called Purely Belter that came out at the same time.
Brilliant as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's Mark Herman who did Brastoff, the same director. And I think it's a real magical little film, but not many people know about it because it didn't. Here's a little prejudice thing. When Billy Elliot and Purely Belter came out at the same time, they said about Purely Belter, oh, we've already got one film from the Northeast.
Oh my God, see, I know.
Can you imagine that being said about London? No, we've got a film set in London.
Yes, yeah.
We couldn't have two. That'd be too much.
I mean, I suppose not the bad timing coming out, any film coming out against Billy Elliot, I suppose, only because some films just do. Purely Belter is amazing as well, but I suppose something you can't put your finger on what's going to literally hit. I mean, I remember The Greatest Showman, hearing an interview with Hugh Jackman when they had to actually pitch it to studio execs, they had to sing to get money because people were saying no. And you just think, my God, look at where that went. And if you watch, you'll have to watch it, Charlie. It's online. But you're now obviously in Ackley Bridge as Sue Carp, another brilliant character. I read, again, something I read. What can I read my writing here? She's a professional nightmare, a loose cannon. And you described her as thinking she's the jailer in charge of the punishment wing.
She's horrible. She's foul.
Was it a character that jumped off the page again to you when you got sent?
I couldn't believe it. When they sent me the bit of script, I thought, I would give my right arm to do this. This is just, she's fantastic. And she is appalling. She's absolutely appalling. But I know that I could push the cheek of it.
Yeah.
But not sweetener, not, you know, the same as well. I'm not interested in making. And then in the end, she was nice. Because in the end, she isn't.
Yes, yeah.
You know, but it's great, and I love working with the young people. I've got a classroom, Manly.
It must be really. I mean, it's. Well, I kind of love what I love about actors is you get to play these roles. You know, like you get to play a teacher, which part of me would always love to be a teacher. Like you actually get to go to work and do this thing, and then come home and forget about it.
It's a bit like we're seeing in the Woolpack when you're in a classroom. So you've got like 10. The main young actors in, and then, you know, 15 supporting artists, and you're doing a performance.
Yeah.
But so is teaching. That's exactly what teaching is. It's a performance to you.
I know, and I think, well, I think homeschooling is proving to all parents the job that teachers do is incredible. They can't even cope with their own kids, let alone having a classroom of 30.
So mine's great because I don't have to wait till it goes to the bell. I just have to wait for and cut.
But yeah, and then you're right. Do you film it at a real school?
Yeah, yeah. It's wonderful. So, you know, a bit like I said about the B&B, I'm in a schoolroom.
Yeah.
Overlooks the Bronte Hills of Halifax. And
wow.
Most of the young people who are in it are cast from the local area. The supporting artists are all what they call street cast. So they're just kids.
Oh, brilliant.
In the area, and it's a huge mix, you know, because if people don't know the series, it's about a white school and an Asian school, high school, that have to combine. So they face head on Islamophobia, homophobia, you know, all the things that I absolutely think is vital that we tackle, you know, all of the political issues and things affect young people. You know, there was a young Muslim lesbian lass was heading, she was the lead in the first two series.
Brilliant.
And, oh, it's groundbreaking and really brave writing, and it's diverse writers, diverse crew, diverse cast. It's so progressive, and I adore being part of it. And going to work and kids coming up and going, how are you doing, bro?
Oh, brilliant. You're down with it now, Charlie. But you saying that leads me to my last point, which I totally and utterly respect you for, because you've always said, you know, what you love about the ability of drama is to, you know, counter ignorance and racism and prejudice, like we were talking about, which is great that you've got this platform that you do, you know, that I think people who don't do any, you know, you have got that platform to do it, and it's amazing. So Black Lives Matter, for instance, must be amazing for you to see things coming like that happening within our TV world.
Absolutely thrilled when the footballers take a knee before the match. Absolutely thrilled that it's part of, you know, kick racism out, show racism, the red card, which is a thing I've been involved in for years, that sport has now gone, right, stop fannying about with this.
Yeah.
This is what we believe. And Sky has adopted, you know, it makes me very glad to the core of my heart that as a country we are progressing in this way and tackling that level of prejudice. I can't bear prejudice, and I cannot bear inequality, and I cannot bear injustice. So if I can be of assistance by telling stories that count as it, I'm as happy as a pig in muck.
Well, Charlie, it's been so amazing to speak to you. Thanks for coming on. And just, yeah, brilliant to talk to you. And I still miss Val.
Oh, she's there somewhere.
She's there. She's in our heart.
I'd like to thank you, because I've been on a little trip down memory lane in detail, and I didn't half enjoy it.
Oh, good.
I love Val still.
Yes, and it's lovely to, like I said, the whole point of this is to give people out there a chance to, you know, take a trip down memory lane as well and celebrate these people and the people who play them. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Lee.
The brilliant Charlie Hardwick. We have had so much fun over the years. Thank you so much to Charlie for coming on this season of Soap from the Box. Remember, there are two episodes every Sunday. There's another one you can listen to right now. It's Hollyoaks star Ross Adams, who I know from working in the office with him on Coronation Street. Find out more about that if you listen now. I'd like to thank David and Eileen Stevens and the Bothy for all their edit and technical wizardry, and also to Ian McCullum for all of his press help. Stay safe and see you next week.